Welcome to the Productize Podcast, the Product Thinking Podcast. So the Productize Podcast is part of the Productize Conference 2024, which we will be holding in Lisbon on October 3rd and 4th. It is a series of interviews with product innovators, successful makers, and entrepreneurs. We hope those who listen to the ideas on this show are inspired to productize and make new things happen. We dive deep into product management, innovation, and leadership. I'm your host, Andre Marquet, and today we have the privilege of chatting with Lea Samarani, a seasoned product management professional whose work has significantly impacted various sectors. Lea now lives and works from Lisbon with her husband and her very cute dog. Lea, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
It's great that, you know, you are now close by, you live in the city, so it's a great opportunity that we have you around. It's a funny story, we actually met at Productize Conference a few years ago.
Yeah, and five, six years ago,
you came to Lisbon. That was your first time in Lisbon, you told me.
It was, yes.
And somehow, here you are.
I moved here.
You moved here.
That's it. One Productize Conference and you moved to Lisbon.
Okay, guys, now you know. Now you know what you're risking. But we did meet at another meetup here a few months ago. And that was really funny because, you know, we were not in each other's radar, and then we realized how things happen. So, funny fact, you've transitioned from public law and political science into product management, which seems to be a quite unique path. I mean, at least it's not as common as maybe you would think first. And my question is really, can you share what inspired this shift and how your background has influenced your approach to product management?
Sure. Do you know any product manager that comes from a product management background? Because I don't.
No. I don't.
You kind of always fall into product, right? It just sort of happens. And that's what happened to me. I studied law and public political science because I wanted to work for the United Nations. I wanted to save the world, you know?
Right.
I found another way to do it by building actual useful product. I actually transitioned first to marketing. I worked as a digital marketer. Then I moved into marketing analysis, which is where I work for digital product. And that's where I found out all about, you know, product management, mm-hmm. and what it is like to build product, what comes behind the scene. And I completely fell in love with it. And then I made it my mission to move into product and haven't regretted it since.
Okay. And that was, you know, you studied in France, I guess.
I studied in France, in Ireland, and in the UK.
And in the UK. Mm. And you started working in the UK.
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, I believe charity job was one of your very first product management experiences. And then you kept moving through various roles at Bumble and Uptime app before moving to be an independent professional, has a fractional CPO nowadays, and product growth advisor. So your responsibilities evolved a lot. What are, you know, the key challenges and learnings as you transition from one role to another and you craft this career progression?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Things changed a lot for me because I started my career working for a marketplace. So I found out all about the challenges of marketplaces, you know, the two sides of the coins. And it was quite a big product. We had millions of users. Mm-hmm. So right away, you know, working with big data.
So that was when you were working for?
For charity job.
Charity job. So if people don't know what is charity job, can you just?
Sure. It's the number one job site for the non-for-profit sector. The non-for-profit sector is very big in the UK. It's pretty as big as the public sector in Portugal.
Oh, wow.
And we basically managed all the recruitment. So as a job side, it's a natural marketplace. You have the job advertising, you have the candidate side, and you have the matching of both. And when I worked there, it was also the time where, you know, mobile became the number one platform people were using. Mobile were growing a lot.
So this was back in 2000 and...
I want to say 2012, 2013. And basically back then, the recruitment sector was pretty behind in general. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really being, digitalized or revolutionized like other industry. This is before, Uber, at least in the UK. And so a lot of our work was focused on that, and it was super interesting, and it had its own set of challenges. But then I moved to B2C product, mm-hmm. native product application, which come with a completely different set of challenges. I moved from startup to scale up, which is also very different in the way, you work with people, the pace, even the way you prioritize your work is different. Mm-hmm. And I then also moved to startup where, you have investors and you have...
Just to guide us on this journey. So you were at Charity Job, which was... not exactly a startup, right? It was already like a big platform per se.
It was more of a 2.0 business, booming with the internet. So it was growing, it was still growing. But in terms of setup, it was very small. When I joined, I think we were maybe 15 or so people working there.
Were you, you were the first product manager?
There were a product person before me. And when that person left, I moved into that role.
Okay. So quite a challenge for something, for someone that actually just started their career in product. You had no mentor, you kind of...
I did. I think I had one of the best setup to start my career into product. I was very lucky because it was a digital product, because we had a lot of data, because it was a time where the industry was changing. So we were also changing internally, changing the tech, changing the ways of working. Mm-hmm. The company actually also invested in me. They sent me to courses, I did classes, and they hired a mentor as well to guide me through.
Wow.
And my mentor was the first product person, I believe, at Headspace. So also someone...
That was an external person they hired to help you... on a job.
Navigate that, yes.
All right, that's a very, I would say, uncommon approach.
Oh yeah, I was genuinely very, very lucky at the beginning of my career. And I think he allowed me to learn so much more than I would have in the more traditional path and to move faster as well.
Wow. So what was your biggest achievement at Charity Job?
Oof. I was there for many years, so that's a loaded question. I really think about it as my teams back then. That's really what I'm the most proud of because, when I joined, so as I say, I took over that product, person that left, but we didn't necessarily have, a product focus mentality. Mm-hmm. It wasn't necessarily data led just yet. Mm-hmm. And, during my time there, with obviously the support of, the founder and the rest of the team, we built a product team, we built a data team, we built a marketing team, we built a design team, and we had all those people. So
you had a good alignment with the CEO.
Yes, yes, very
and
good.
And founder.
Yes, yeah, yeah, very good. Very good alignment. A thought went into how we would tackle those things and how we would grow. It wasn't just,
What was the North Star of a company like Charity Job?
I mean, it's a marketplace, so it's a transactional North Star. For us, it was number of application per jobs. So we knew that to make a hire, you needed to have a certain amount of application for your job. We knew that to get that, you needed a certain amount of people viewing those jobs, searching for it. And that tackled both sides of the funnel. So you needed recruiter, you need jobs, you needed candidates, you need a good algorithm to match them together, ensure that, you don't have five jobs with thousands of applications and everything else with nothing. So it was very standard marketplace metric and ways of working.
Right. There was no specificity on the fact that you were working on the third sector.
I think there were because the third sector is also even more behind in some ways on the digital side of things. Mm-hmm. And when we started, I don't think they were really measuring the cost per application, the ROI on application. And during that time, they started really paying attention to that, where the rest of the industry was already doing that. So for us, it was an opportunity to almost, help educate the sector on best practice outside of the sector and bring that to the sector. So it gave us almost a bit of an advantage because you have you could see the future in a way from other sector and then bring it to the industry.
Right. And there's so many opportunities like like that, right? So, which are essentially arbitrage of knowledge, because some tech sectors and IT in particular, they tend to be avant-garde. They tend to be, you know, at the very edge of what is being done, and other sectors are left behind. So, you know, bringing those best practices to those sectors that are left behind is probably always a good opportunity. But, you know, you went, and this is the funny story, right? You went from, let's say, the white side of the force to, you know, kind of the dark side. And this is just a tease, right? But he ended up working for Bumble, which I guess it's a very different transactional market, kind of marketplace as well. So why the change? What happened here? What was really the trigger to and the pivotal moment to go into this other chapter?
I mean, I think I just wanted to try something new. At some point, you kind of, I don't want to say you know everything, but you know your product really well. You've you know, overcome a lot of the challenges. At some point, you just need something new, a new challenge, something new to learn as well. I was managing teams, as I mentioned, and I also wanted to get back into the craft, doing things myself, getting my hand dirty again. I wanted to make sure that I keep up with the new tech, with what was happening. And so, you know, that opportunity came my way, and it was really interesting. It's a completely different model. We're talking about more network. So it's not a marketplace per se. It's really more of a network, social network sort of space. And you have completely different set of challenges there as well. And also it's mobile. It's right. Native apps.
I guess most people that are listening know what is Bumble, but if in case they don't know or haven't used, how would you describe what Bumble is?
A dating apps. I think everybody know what dating apps right. are nowadays.
It's a dating app.
Yes.
Right. Is it different from any other dating app out there at the end of the day?
In some ways, yes. In others, I think most of them have similar set of challenges and similar set of goals. So I've worked with a lot of dating apps since, and I've seen a lot of the same challenges again repeating themselves over time.
Which are?
Your users are a huge part of your product. People are here to meet other people.
Right.
So that early network effect, people being able to find other people on your product very early on is key. And I see a lot of dating apps lately launching, and, you know, they have really nice set of features and they have a nice branding, a nice positioning, but they don't necessarily think of the people using that platform as being part of the product. And if you really think about it, they are. This is the same as, I don't know, a nightclub. If you go to a nightclub and there's absolutely no one there, even if there's nice sofas and nice drinks, would you stay? You wouldn't. You would probably leave and think it's not a great place. And so it's exactly the same with all those dating apps that have a need for network effect. And nowadays we're in a space in time where acquiring this user is not so easy. It isn't. You need to have a point of differentiation. You need to have a brand. You need to have something different to offer. And at least back then, I think that's, you know, what Bumble did really well. They had that. They had this differentiation.
Which was?
I put women first. Women makes the first move.
All right. So, I found this quite interesting because in your LinkedIn description, when I was preparing for this podcast, you mentioned scaling an app from 0 to 1 million users. Can you walk us through the initial stages of that project and what strategies did you employ to achieve such remarkable growth? And of course, if you can tell us which.
So before you can actually scale an app to 1 million users, you need to launch an app.
Right.
And then you need to find product market fit or some version of that. And then you can scale. So scaling somehow in that story was almost the easy part. The first two parts were much more difficult. And I think from having spoken to a lot of other people that went through similar experiences, it's quite common, I think, to have more challenges in the very early days and then found the rest of the journey a bit easier. So first, the main challenges was to launch the first product. You know, you have a lot of uncertainty at that time. You don't necessarily know what to do. There's no indication of, you know, you being right or wrong. You have to concretely build something to be able to test it, to see if the market is going to accept it or not, to then decide the right direction to go into. And getting to that first point, the fastest possible way with, you know, the least cost, was definitely, for me, in my personal experience, the most challenging thing. Mm-hmm. It's not natural for me to take decision that way without knowing, without great indication or without data. You don't have a product, so you don't have data. So that was the first step. And then, you know, product market fit, how do you define it?
Exactly.
How, you know, are we talking download, people using your app, retention, revenue? How do you define that? And the way it's defined for different products is actually not quite the same, and for a different stage of the product as well. So at what point do you say we have enough indication that this is a valuable product that we can actually push that will scale? In that case, that wasn't the case. The first version didn't really do well. We had to pivot into a new product, a very different offering, which actually this time worked really well. So that's, again, a very different challenge where you have to find early indication and make decision based on that with again, a very high level of uncertainty and, you know, pressure and pace. So I think for me, this is way more challenging than actually having that product that have found the market and then scaling.
But you were there from zero.
Yeah, I was there from zero.
Right, so you had to go through launching and product market fit and all the stages. So maybe let's start from the beginning. What kind of product was this?
It's an application. It's an education app. Mm-hmm. And the early days of the application, the vision was to have an education application that's easy and simple to use, that people can spend a bit of time on it and basically use it instead of using social media in their downtime. So, you know, you still want to have some fun and learn something quickly, but you want to feel good about yourself because you learned something.
Right.
So that was kind of the early days vision. And then we went on about making that happen.
So are you part of the founding team or
no.
You were hired in a very...
I think I was third or fourth, maybe, person joining the team.
Okay, so very early stage.
Very early stage. As in, I chose what coffee goes
users,
into the office. You know?
Great vision, great product pitch, but that was it. So what happened next?
You need to decide what you're building. That's what happened next. So how do you decide? In our case, we did a lot of research. I personally tested, I think, 60 plus applications.
Because you were hired as a product manager.
Yes,
for
I was product person. I tested a lot of applications, not necessarily in education, in all sector, and tried to understand from those different products what was existing in the world. But the most interesting part of it for me wasn't to test the product, it was to read the reviews. So I read all the reviews on 60 plus something product. And all those reviews is almost, you know, it's like the world is screaming at you, this is a product I need. This is a product I want. Please build it for me. And at some point, it became really clear that there's such a need in the market between... there was such a need in the market for people that... they wanted something that was trustworthy. It was, you know, the time of fake news, of social media being bad for you. So there's clearly a need for something that you can trust, something that's worthy of your time, something that's going to make you feel good about learning.
So that was the opportunity you decided to double bet on in terms of the app? Was it trust and making it very trustworthy in terms of the content?
No. So there were three things really. So that was one of them.
Right.
The second one was that all the app that pretend to do that, they're not a great product. If you look at them really, if you use them, if you look at their review, you know, they're clunky, they're not fun, they're hard to use, they're very long. So there's also a lot of frustration with product that try to achieve that. And then you have this third category, which are products that are fantastic. They have an amazing user experience. They're fun to use. They're good for you. But they're very niche. They're very specific. So I'm talking language app, for example, right? They're really good. They really change the way you learn. Or meditation app.
Right. Like things like Duolingo and...
Exactly. So you've got...
Headspace.
Exactly. So you've got those, that kind of three category that overlap a little bit, but aren't quite the same. They don't answer the same problem. They don't answer the same need. And when you look at what people wanted, well, when I read all this review back then, you could clearly see that there were a need for something in the middle. So something that would...
So that was your thesis. Let's do something in the middle, in the intersection of these three...
That was when I had my own, you know, aha moment about it around this is, you know, this is something that's, that there's a clear user problem here. There's a clear need on the market there, and there isn't an existing solution there. This is a problem we can solve. That was a clear moment in my head where I went, okay, I can see that. I can see that. The rest of the team too, I want to say. I think pretty much everybody was pretty convinced about it.
That's the job of the product manager, right? That many have
it wasn't just in my head.
Work on persuading others. So I guess things kind of worked into that direction because
No.
So what happened here?
Startup are not a straightforward journey. You don't just see a problem and then you come up with a first solution and your solution is perfect. You fix it and here you go. You're on a perfect path. It's
right.
Way more...
Rose, let's actually...
No, it's way more complicated. So we went on with the first attempt, which was a really good, you know, fake it until you make it sort of attempt. So proper MVP, very fast, delivered something, put it out to the market, and the market pretty much told us, like, that's no. Thank you very much.
So let's just jump into the whole deliverable thing and delivering to the market. What's your process here? You just put app out there and ask people to use it, or... You emailed a bunch of users. What was your approach to get this initial?
We did an alpha launch where we had a list of, you know, friends, family, people that showed interest, and had this alpha launch of user that we put on a test flight, a version of the product, and, you know, asked for regular feedback, worked with them. In hindsight, I don't think that was necessarily the best idea. I think that was our version of a community, but I'm not sure we understood how different that group of people was from the people we're building the product from and how their need could be different. You know, we're talking business people here and friend of startup founders, that kind of thing. So it's very biased towards a certain type of personality, certain interest.
What kind of content was this app for?
At that time, it was a video-based product. We use any kind of content.
Right, very open.
Very open, yes.
Right.
No vertical.
More of a white label kind of product. People could do their courses there.
It wasn't even courses. It was
factoids.
Yeah, it was playlists that talked about a subject in a way that was vetted, so that you knew that there was some level of...
curation.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so this didn't go well, or at least didn't go to your expectations. What did you do next?
You pivot. I'm traumatized by that word now.
Why traumatized? I mean,
it's not. It's so easy to say, and afterwards, when it happens, you're just like, yeah, that was the obvious choice. But when that happened, I remember myself thinking, wow, are we really? You know, we put so much effort into that. We just built that product. We just tried it. We didn't try it for very long, and we're just chopping and changing the direction. And it's something that's it's not something that's natural to do. And I think this is why you see the difference with an experienced funding team and an inexperienced funding team. And in that case, we had a very experienced funding team that had that experience multiple times before and knew when it was the right time to make the decision. And for me personally, it was a fantastic learning experience because, you know, they were right. We had to pivot.
Okay, so let's go into metrics. Another fact that I think you're quite proud is the fact that you have helped several projects improve their conversion rates to paid users by several orders of magnitude percentage wise in terms of at least MRR, which is, you know, no small feat. So could you dive into how you approach optimization and conversion in these experiences? And were there any surprising insights that helped you achieve these numbers?
Yeah, I have done that a few times now, and I've done that on company of various size. So one startup, we launched monetization from zero. They were no monetization. Another one had a monetization model going on for five or six years that had completely plateaued. One was much bigger company that where the number actually were going down over time. So there were very various size and setup for monetization, but every time the same framework pretty much worked. And the framework is really simple. You know, it's first you start with a user, you understand what's the real value of the product. So what are they here for? What are they buying for? You can do that with job to be done interviews. You can also do that with, again, reading the reviews inside. I mean, talking to people.
Are you a fan of the Sean Halley's?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty good methodology. I think it's a, you know, it works. And then when you get that, I also like to do it with the data, especially if you have data. At that stage is when, you know, you realize that actually data is bad, is not trustworthy, or it's just you have multiple systems, they all tell a different story, there's no documentation, no one actually know what you're tracking, what things means. But that's pretty much always the case. So that's actually what takes the longest. It's just clean up the data and get a real story. And once you have that done, you've got your insights and you've got the big data and you know exactly, you know, what's happening, you know, when people are dropping. You know what's the engagement moment on your platform, what's the activation point where people are sticking around, and you know why they're sticking around. And you can use this information to optimize, of course, all your flow and your product and the activation flow, but also your monetization. And at that stage, it's just about testing it. So now that, you know why they're here, you know why they're buying, you know when they're buying, you know when they find the value, you know when they're dropping. It's just about constantly testing on this hypothesis.
On each part of the funnel?
Yes. And the smaller the test, the better at that stage because you don't know much.
Right.
You have all this hypothesis and all those insights, but really that's all you have. You don't really know much. So we want to test as much as we can, as fast as we can. I like to have 2, 3, 4 tests running every week if we can. At least have something new launching every week. So quite regular, fast pace. There's a lot of tool right now that allow you to do that actually, to even test without release. So it's great. And the test itself, they need to be very clear, right? You want to have a very clear hypothesis. You want to know exactly what you're measuring. You want to know what success would look like. And most importantly, you want to know how is the result going to inform your decision-making? Because we're talking about very small tests. And once you know that and you run that test and you get the results, then you can go on to maybe more traditional ways of working when you build something a bit bigger and take a bit more time and do it properly. And then repeat and repeat and repeat and it works.
So your work has not only focused on, but also on significantly increasing engagement metrics like MAU, you know, monthly active users. So what kind of methodologies or experiments did you find the most effective in enhancing user engagement?
It's very similar to what I said with monetization. Of course, it's not always, you know, small things and it's not always simple. But often you can make it simple and you can make it small. But it's still very much the same. Like find out where the value is. If you have, you know, to talk to people, to check your user, to get user feedback, find out what the value is qualitatively, and then go and validate that quantitatively on your product. And the difference for me is that it's much, much harder to impact engagement and retention than it is to impact activation and monetization. And mostly because the first one is almost something that happened at one point in the funnel, and it's very early on in the funnel. Usually most at least in application, most application monetize very early on. But engagement is something that require repeat usage. It require creating a habit, and that takes time.
Right.
And at that stage, you're not just competing with, other product and building a great product. You're competing with pretty much everything in a person's life. Which is much harder to quantify as well. You know, how do you quantify that someone today had a longer day at work, or, you know, their kid is sick and then they can't actually use your product? How do you quantify that against, well, we build this great feature that actually trigger a will in them to come back and use a product again?
So I guess that's also why you're such a big fan of experimentation, and that's such a part of your cornerstone of your strategy. Can you describe some of the processes for designing and prioritizing experiments? How do you measure success? Can you just guide us through that?
Sure. So again, it starts with the knowledge. So if you have a mature product, you have a lot of knowledge. If it's a brand new product, you really have to go out and talk to people. As I said, I went from, you know, reading reviews and that created hypothesis to actually getting user feedback or data as well. Data is amazing to create hypothesis. And then once you have a hypothesis, we want it to be very clear, concise. We wanted to have a clear, not a binary yes or no answer, but as close to that as can be. And then you go on to design your experiment. And this is where it gets interesting, because we start with this idea, and the idea itself can be a really big idea, right? We're going to go into a new market. We're going to have a new feature, a new experience in the product. It can be something quite big. Mm-hmm. But the experiment on how we want to validate that idea, at least the first one, we want it to be as small as possible so we can validate that quickly. If I give you an example, if we say, people will consume content much more if it's recommended for them and it's personalized to their need.
So that's an hypothesis.
That's a hypothesis. Then how do you go and build that? So you could say, well, we're going to build this algorithm and we're going to recommend content to people and we're going to put that on their homepage and, you know, see if they consume more content. That's quite a big experiment, right? I have to go and build an algorithm. Right. It's going to have to run for a while and it's a fair amount of data to work. I could also fake it. I could completely fake it. I can pick from, you know, onboarding. I know exactly what you told me that you were interested in. And there's a handful of users and I'm going to serve content for this handful of users that is presented as if it came from an algorithm and is very faked and it's very small. And this is a very small experiment to run, actually, to put in place. It's not difficult to put in place.
It's more of almost a Wizard of Oz kind of experiment.
Yeah, you fake it. As much as you can, you fake it. There's no backend involved here. There's no server side. It's only a perception.
Right. Smokes and mirrors.
Exactly. And then that test can run pretty fast because it doesn't require a lot of work. Depending on how many users you have, of course, the duration will be different. Mm-hmm. But it's not difficult nowadays to get information on, you know, how much user you need to get statistical significance. And how long your test need to run for. I like to say at least 2 weeks, and some tests can run for shorter, but I think 2 weeks is really a minimum to get, to avoid some of the bias that happen when you launch something new. And preferably new users, not running on old users, because then you avoid, you know, the time of, you avoid the impact of having a new experience. So changing the UX or anything like that required time of adaptation. Right. So if you do it on your user, you get data faster.
So you have fresh data, no biases.
Exactly.
So of course you have been recognized as, one of the, with the Experimentation Award finalists of 2023. What advice would you give to companies looking to build a culture of experimentation within their teams? And I guess maybe bigger companies, right, that sometimes struggle to move fast because they have, very stable, I would say almost ossified structure. So for them, experimentation is seen as a very alien kind of thing. So how can they start? What can they do in a way that might actually be meaningful for them?
It's, in my experience, it's so much harder to change a culture than to create a culture from the beginning. So if you are a new company, I would advise to bring that on very early on from the beginning, and even
experimentation.
Yes, even you don't have a lot of users, even if it's going to be tiny tests, it brings in a framework, a culture, a way of working, ensure we have data quite early on. So it's something I would try to bring on very early on in the process.
Who should bring that in a early stage company now? Is that the job of the CEO or the first product management hires?
Usually, you know, in the startup, in the first few days, maybe not the first few days, but early on, you don't always even have product people. Mm-hmm. Your founders are your product people. Right. You might have a few engineers. It depends on the setup. I was very lucky to often have product analysts and researchers and big product teams. So you have a whole team that mm-hmm. can bring that on. But as a product person, I think it's your job to make sure that this is at the forefront of the thinking, at least, that we know that at some point this needs to happen. It doesn't need to happen right away. You need a product first. Again, there's a few things that you need first, but you start thinking about it. So it means that when you launch thing, you launch it with data. Your data structure is built in a way that it can scale. You have documentation in a way that it will be useful in the future. It doesn't need to be cumbersome. It's not big, you know, piece of paper or Notion or whatever. It's just, it's simple, but it's there. It exists. And
well, what's your favorite tool for that? Is it
for experimentation or
For documentation? Is it you know, for, is it you Notion know,
for event tracking? I use Google Sheets, and it doesn't need to be sophisticated. You can mm-hmm. put a screenshot of the page, and next to it you have the name of the events, and that's it. And then when you're looking for it, it's there. There are more sophisticated tools, there are more sophisticated way, but in the early days, you don't need that. You just need somewhere that when someone wants an information, they can go and they can find what they're looking for and the reference. And usually visual is the easiest way to do it. You have a visual, you have a naming next to it. It's very simple. And it's not, the early days of product are not that big. You don't have that much to track. And once you have that, then you can bring experimentation, because you've got those data, you've got the tracking, you have the mindset, then you can bring experimentation early on for your team. Your question specifically for bigger team, for culture that have been set up that way, is a lot harder. I'm trying to do that right now with one of my teams, and it's very challenging because you have BAU going on, you have a lot of competing priority in the business. And there's also, it's not necessarily a lack of understanding of the value of experiment, but experiment is something that you believe in once you've seen how impactful it can be. Before that, people tend to also see the fact that, you know, it might slow down things, it's more work. Engineers especially don't necessarily like it. It's more things to maintain. And you think about it in a way as in, how is that going to help us?
Right.
You know, we build a product, we got so far on almost our gut feeling. Clearly, we know what we're doing. How is that going to help us?
How do you sell it internally?
Well, you know, there are stats out there, like 7-9 out of 10 experiments fail.
Right.
For a good reason, actually, that we don't know much.
Right.
You know, we don't know what's working. We don't know what's not working. We don't know why. And in my experience, experimentation actually allows you to move faster, not slower. Because when you build something thinking it's going to be an experiment, you don't go on and build, you know, the most complex project. You go on, you build a very MVP way. You validate it. So it de-risk everything, which means that you actually move faster, not slower.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, there are, you know, a bit more things to maintain, etc. But it forces good practice, and that's not a bad thing as well. To sell it, a lot of external stats, how other companies do it, how, you know, best company on the market have used that to their advantage. Internal stats, things that we've done in the past that we know now we're not successful, how much time we've wasted, how much effort we've wasted on something that we could have validated. And then the best way is really to run the first test and make that first test successful. So it's almost a fake first test. It's a test for PR.
I love it.
And so to run that, you need to find something super small and simple so it can get built quickly.
And you have to have, you know, insights.
Very strong insights,
and
yes.
Allies inside the company as well, right?
Yes.
You know, it's fake to the point that you're not deceiving people.
No, it's a real test. You run a real test.
It's a real test.
You need to pick that test in a way where it has more chance of getting to significance. It doesn't have to be better. You can fail. The test can fail. It's better if it wins, if the new variant wins. But what's very important is that the test reached significant, that it's not a test that doesn't have results, where people would say, well, see, you run that experiment and you found out nothing. And we wasted time.
Right. Okay, so indulge me. What's the best way to set up such a test? You know, is there any framework that you use for that very, very first
I don't have a framework for it, but if I think about it, I usually pick something that's top of the funnel. So we know we have a lot of users.
Right.
So we'll get results quickly. Something ideally that's simple, so a step. So, you know, we're not going to go and launch an entirely new feature or experience. Something very measurable, like, you know, a paywall or an onboarding flow, a step that is very measurable. You know exactly how it's performing.
Mm-hmm.
And the test itself, I mean, it depends, but, you know, that's probably the hardest part, but ideally you have enough data and hypothesis to know that something, is worth your time or effort. So maybe you have a step where there's a huge drop off. And so anything you might test on this step is more likely to give you results. Or you have, if you have a step where, you know, 98% of people are going to the next step, maybe that's not the right place to test because you're not going to get significant result or anything of value.
It's going to be very incremental.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we need something quite deep. So the way I did in the past is we had, early on in the funnel, we had this step that you had to go through before you could get to the main product experiments. And I don't remember the exact number, but about 40-45% of people were dropping on that step. So this is where we did the test, and the test was skipping that step. It was as simple as that. We just skip that step in the funnel.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost obvious, right? You skip a step in the funnel, people will get to the next one, right?
Right.
And it was a simple measurement, a simple test, but it drove this belief within the company that experiment means something, that it's useful, that it will tell us something, the direction to go in. And thanks to that, every single time we had changes that happened in the metric, we could always go back and say, this is due to a product change or not. And this is very important.
Mm-hmm. Because you have the hard data, the evidence to lead into that conclusion.
Because in a startup, I mean, even in a big company, you spend a huge amount of time just investigating why something is going a certain way.
Mm-hmm,
and most of the time you have no idea and you just need to investigate. And if you think it's something to do with a product release and you haven't tested it in this experiment, you're questioning the entire work of everybody.
So you can have almost a proactive approach to it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's a lot of discussion where experimentation should go and inside a product team, who should lead it. And from your own experience, you've been managing teams across various stages of product development. Also, I guess that requires adaptability. So how do you tailor your leadership style to meet the needs of different projects and teams? And now that you are a consultant, I guess that's happening a lot of, you know, very frequently. And can you provide an example where you had to significantly adapt your approach because it was very challenging and, you know, your tool set was not working as it should?
I had very, very different teams. And for me, there's a couple of things that really stand out. There's a very senior team. And by senior, I mean people that where the entire team have a product mindset, where the entire team really understand what we're doing, why we're doing it. And, you know, people are very proactive in finding solution. You don't really have to babysit. You don't have to push. And this kind of team is the dream team. I think everybody would love to have a team like that. And with those teams, you don't want to, as a product person, your only job is to ensure they get the information they need, that they know why, that they get the data, that they get the insight, and you feeding those brain to make the product decision. They own the product more than the product person.
Mm-hmm.
And that for me was a big transition because it's very different from, you know, team where product manager is almost a dictator on kind of pushing team in one direction.
So that would be what Marty Kagan calls a very empowered team.
Yes, yeah. And you can't achieve, maybe you can, I haven't said it, but I think you can only achieve it when you have a certain kind of people that are fairly senior, that, you know, care about their craft, that are very keen, they want to know why they're doing something.
Very curious.
Those people also tend to be very opinionated. Yes. And, you know, it's lively discussion, but if you are able to provide this team with the right insight and the right data, I think 95% of the time you can trust that decision and not even have to get involved. And as a product person, this is a very different way of working. You know, I'm not telling you this is the right path or this is the experience that must happen on the product. I'm telling you what is the problem we're trying to solve. And between the product designer and the engineer, they're coming up with a solution. Mm-hmm. And you're not coming up with that solution. So you're outsourcing your brain and you have an entire team that's coming up with a solution instead. And so this is a very different way of working. This is, for me, it's the best way of working, but it's very difficult to achieve with teams that are used to working other way or a team that are more junior.
Mm-hmm. So you get to choose the teams you want to work with. You get to choose as a consultant. I mean, are you picky? They say this, I'm not taking this job because I don't think this will.
I'm not picky on the, not on the team itself. I'm stupidly optimistic and I think I can change, you know, the culture in every team. It's very hard sometimes, but I pick more. I think the buy-in needs to come from the top. If the founder doesn't think that this is possible and you don't have that trust and buy-in with the founder, this is a project I don't really want to go in because it's going to be a battle and you're not, you know, changing a culture inside a team is something, but changing it without the buying from right. The founders and the CEOs is just, it's not a battle I want to spend my time on. And I think that's more how I choose my team is really, you know, what's the leadership of the company looking like? Because in the founding team, in startup, what you found, I mean, at least what I found a lot is people that are really good at something. They have an extreme amount of knowledge about something and they don't have the same level of knowledge on, you know, the product side of thing, on how to run experiment or how to get insights or how to get a team to work in a more efficient ways. And that's why I come in. So I can learn from them on this area where they are extremely good at and maybe I'm not as knowledgeable about. You know, at the moment I'm learning a lot about B2B and how to close deal. This is not something I was very familiar with. And I can bring my side of the story, which is the way you're running your product team and the way your team is working together can be much, much better. And this is how we can go about that. And as long as you have the buy-in, that's enough to go.
Okay, so let's maybe start to wrap up the conversation a little bit about the future. There's this ongoing discussion also with the launch of the new book of Marty Kagan's regarding product management theater and, you know, a lot of the things that is now going on is not really impactful. And of course, you are very close to the bottom line because when it comes to MRR, MAU, you know, you cannot fake it too much to a certain point, right? You know, things are what they are and you have to deliver and, and, you know, those numbers are not going to lie for too long. So as we look to the future, what emerging trends in product management are you most excited about and how do you plan to leverage them in your upcoming projects?
That's a very interesting question. You know, we talked about this product mindset in the teams. And the way I see it, I think product manager as a profession is completely going to change because of that. I think we're going to find engineer that have product responsibility, designer that have product responsibility, analyst as well. And we are going to move towards more product teams rather than product manager. And the role of product manager, I believe, is going to be forced into evolution. What that evolution looks like, I'm not sure. It could be a bit more of a more strategic level, or it could be an added skills. So you're product manager, but you're also a designer, an analyst, or an engineer. I'm not sure exactly, but I can really see how this mindset growing in squad brings the best value for a business. And so this is something that people are going to be looking for more and more. And the more you have this product mindset in your team, the more time product manager have to do something else. And that something else needs to bring value to the company for the role to be still there, to exist. So that's what I'm more interested about. What is this something else going to be? I think it's going to be something around more strategic, maybe more in-depth. But this is what I'm really curious about.
Any teases? Is it?
Maybe we'll have a ratio with less product manager for more squads, more teams. Maybe you spend way more time on research and discovery and insight and actually really thinking before building something. Maybe there's going to be a bit of project management coming back into it. I don't know. I hope not, but maybe. Or it's the skill. So you're product manager, but you're also, analyst, and you can get your data and you can run your tests and analyze your tests. And I think the role is going to be forced into evolution. And I think it's a good thing because it's going to move us away from, product manager that aren't really product manager, that actually want to be but can't be because of the way the company works or the way things are set up. I'm actually excited about it. It's a bit scary, but I'm excited about it.
How can our listeners connect with you, follow your work if they're interested in learning or just, potentially collaborating? What is the best way to reach you?
On LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn, Leah Samrani. I think I'm the only one, so it should be easy to find. That's my only social network. So.
And you have plenty of videos out there on YouTube if people want to find you on several talks. You've been a speaker to several conferences and events in the last year, and hopefully this 2024. Do you have any upcoming event?
Yes, actually. I'm doing a talk here in Lisbon next week.
Yes, the Productized Talks. Thanks for the plug. Yeah.
And then I'm going to London in a month for the App Promotion Summit as well. Where I'll be engaging. I think I'm running a roundtable, which is a different format. It's quite interesting as well. We go more in depth in conversation. I don't know what's next, but usually there's more.
Okay. So if you are in Lisbon, join us. We'll be at Coffee Dis Towers at the Joyeux Café for the Productized Talks. And Leah is going to be there. She's going to give a talk. So make sure you join us. So thank you so much, Leah. It's been really a pleasure.
Thank you.
To have you today with us and sharing such valuable insights and, I would say perspectives that are not so common, especially about the future of what is in shelf for product managers. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. Remember to keep learning, growing, and pushing the boundaries of productization. Until next time, don't forget that we are going to have Leah with us on the first Productized Talks, precisely on how to increase your revenue metrics and many other interesting perspectives also from the Coffee Dis people. That's going to happen on March 21st at the Coffee Dis building, Joyeux Café, here in Lisbon. Do wear SVP on our meetup page. We're also going to drop the link for some cool beers with the product people here in Lisbon. This is André Marquis. I'm signing off from the Productized Podcast, the Product Thinking Podcast, and I'm your host and producer, media and video coverage by Afonso Lopes, with us today, and sound editing by Teresa Castro. Thank you.